Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody's got the fever. This is something we all know. Fever isn't such a new thing. Fever started long ago.
Good evening and welcome to Lenny Godfrey Straight, No Chaser. Well, normally I am ready to do my little housekeeping, which I will do, but for a few minutes more I have a couple of things that I wanted to talk about. But first, let me just say, if you're interested in calling in and making a comment or asking a question, the number is 516-453-6063. If you want to see past or hear past episodes of the Lenny Godfrey No Chaser, Straight No Chaser episodes, then you can go to blogtalkradio.com/ S is in Sam, F is in Fred, T is in Tom, H is in Harry, the number 2. And there, all of our listings are there for you to hear anything that you've missed or you want to hear again. You can go to YouTube and see the videos after show afterthoughts that we're doing, and they also appear on the Facebook Godly Entertainment page. Now, that all said, the housekeeping is just about done, but it's been a challenging week here, and I just want to take the time out to acknowledge one of my dear friends who has passed away. My friend Robin Staff is married and was married to a man called Marty Staff. And Marty and Robin for 44 years were a couple. Robin and I were on boards and committees together for about 10 years, and there was always Marty. Marty, to me, was a patron of the arts, an angel of the arts, and an angel in general. Unfortunately, yesterday, Marty passed away. Friday, Carl and I had an opportunity to go and see Marty, and because we had to make sure that we were in a position of health, because it's a sterile environment, we waited until we got our shots and entered in. And as I announced, "Marty, it's Lenny. I'm coming to visit you." In Marty's style, he said, "Well, what took you so long?" I will miss my dear friend. I will miss his support. He is one of those people that we talk about here on this radio program all the time. He is a person who's made a footprint beyond his job description. He was in the business of fashion, but he was very supportive in the arts. And I love he and I love Robin tremendously. And I will miss him and send both of them peace. And with that, you know I have to say I love my friends. Now I want to move on, because this conversation is a continuation of the love of the arts and someone who I believe has made her footprint. She is a producer, a director, an educator, a mother, a mentor. She was a wonderful wife to my wonderful friend, Bill Snyder, an executive in the theater. She's my very, very dear friend and mentor, Patricia B. Snyder. Hello, Patricia.
Hello, Lenny. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you. Sorry about your friend.
Thank you. Thank you. He's a great, great guy. Thank you so very much, Patricia. You know, Patricia, you and I talk a lot, and I said when I wrote about this, like Melba, we have great conversations, and we've talked this week about a lot of different things because we're involved in other different projects, and I often call you about your opinion and things. But our relationship started a little bit after the run of Broadway. My Broadway run was over, and there was a an opportunity for me to come and work for you and with you up in Albany, New York. But before that, I'd like to hear from you, why theater? Why? How did it start way back there? And then we'll catch up to when I finally got to working with you.
Oh, that's a long time for me. I think it started for me as a little girl, and my family, I lived with my mother's mother and my parents, and they were very they were Italian immigrants and very Italian cultured oriented, and the church was very much a part of our everyday life. And I remember going to church for what they call in the Catholic Church a high mass. I don't think they do it that much anymore. And the pageantry, the vestments, the candles, the incense. And I went home and I started taking friends in the neighborhood and moving them around and making processions. And that's when my interest, it was the theater for me. Of course, I have very deep faith, but it became for me the theater. It transitioned to my life in the theater. That's how it began.
Yeah, I know. Patricia, what, move back a little bit from your phone because I'm getting that static again. So
okay.
Maybe, yeah, that's a little better. That's a little better. Good, good. So you're saying that the grandeur of the church really incited some of the things that we replicate here in the theater, some of the grandeur that we have, it brought it out of you as a little girl. When did Bill come into the whole situation? When did my Bill Schneider come in?
Oh, yes. He loved you too, Winnie. he came into the picture when I was 15 years old. He had transferred in to our high school from Blair Academy in Blairstown, New Jersey. And he had done a lot of theater in high school and was very interested in classical music. And in a way, he became my teacher and my mentor at a very early age.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the beginning. And we were together for 63 years.
63?
Yes, from 15 until last year. From age 15 until last year. We married at age 20. And that was that.
Well, now, Bill, but Bill was not necessarily connected to the theater. You were the theater piece. But again, I'd like to make that connection of how the arts really runs through a lot of things. He was in the arts in a certain way. Won't you explain it?
Well, and again, no, Winnie, because he went to the neighborhood playhouse. He was very definitely in the theater.
Okay, move back a little bit more, Patricia. Move back a little bit more.
He went to the neighborhood playhouse.
Yeah.
He was theater. He did a lot of acting. But He gave it up because he said that the two of us couldn't be in the theater. We'd be broke.
Well, that does make a lot of sense over time, unless somebody got very, very lucky very early on that it would be difficult to have. And you all have a wonderful family also. You have, you know, your sons that had to be a consideration also. You know, I remember going up to Albany and for the first time, and do you remember the circumstances by which I fell into the production of Knickerbocker Follies?
Yes, I do.
Do you want to tell them? Yeah.
We immediately loved you because we were going through a transition.
Yes.
Our organization we merged, the university merged, not by law, but by a letter of agreement with a corporation that was presenting guest artists. And our mission was going to be to bring the best up from New York City to work with us in a building we've called the Egg in Albany.
Yes. And, you know,
the company was a little nervous. And
you came in.
They were a little nervous about the competition from New York or if it would work or if what the demands would be. There were a lot of unknowns. Kind of like life, isn't it?
Yes.
And
well,
you came in with a big smile.
Well, it was a great opportunity. I have to say, it came my way via someone else, and she's a wonderful singer. Gail Nelson was a candidate for that, but then she elected to go and do another gig, which created an opportunity for me to be asked to join you all, and that started a relationship that is, 39 years old now, Patricia?
Yes, Lenny, 39.
I said in another show that it was like 17, and Patricia called me up and said, no, I think you better rethink that. I think it's more than 17 years old. And I went, oh, all right. I guess that was wishful thinking on my part. But I really want to start talking about the things that you accomplished with that company up there. And for me, it was showing how the arts through education really taught adults and children so many different things. Did you, in the very beginning, and we've never really spoken about this, was that purposefully an idea in your mind? Did you really think, well, you know what? I think that I'm going to put this together and have this together. How did that come about? Because it was happening as I was coming there and with all the guest artists and all of us who would come up. But there was a foundation that was there before we got there. How did that start happening, Patricia?
Well, it's a kind of story about going through the back door to get what it was that you wanted to begin with. My parents provided acting lessons for me, and when I went to college, I was offered a full tuition scholarship to major in voice at Syracuse University, and my father would not allow me to accept the scholarship because he said, you have a nice voice, but your kind of voice is a dime a dozen. And so it's not a good idea to spend 4 years majoring in voice. Of course, I didn't agree with him, but I respected my dad and I listened to him. And he said, you need to think about how you can help people, how you can make the world a better place. So he said, you could be a teacher. You could be a nurse. I decided I would be a teacher. I would teach English and teach theater in direct drama club. And I went to college. But my idea all along was I will eventually get into the theater but I will be able to fall back on my teaching degree. And my first year of teaching, I experimented with my students and my drama club. And every play we did, I made a handbook to show how the teachers in the school could connect with the play we were doing and their discipline. And it was just sort of very lightly done. And then I was offered a job at the University at Albany by one of my former professors to develop a children's theater program, because he said the children are the future audience and we need to get them interested in the theater arts. And the theater is a marriage of all of the arts. I had just completed my master's degree at Syracuse University. I was a member of the repertory company of Syracuse Stage, which was then called Syracuse Repertory Theater. And Bill and I, we moved with our two-year-old son to Albany, and I began teaching at the university in the theater department, and continued to develop that notion, because at the time, the colleges were emphasizing interdisciplinary majors on the college campus. It was like during the Kent State strike time, and there was lots of unrest on the campus and so forth. Well, anyway, that's how it all began. We developed a company, and we toured to the schools. This is college students. We developed study guides. We taught in the classroom before and after the show. And in the end, to make it a long story short, Governor Rockefeller thought the idea of theater for children was a good one. And then one of the legislators, who I believe was a friend of Governor Rockefeller, they needed to find a purpose for the egg. And they brought me to the legislature and said, do you think that your program, you could expand your program and be resident in this building? Of course, I thought, I didn't believe what I was being told. So, but that's kind of like a short version of what happened.
Of what it was. But now, what kind of atmosphere was that for a woman at that point in time? Because now, you know, we're talking many years ago. So how did you fit into that equation there? Were you surrounded mostly by men, and how was that treatment for you?
Well, on the theater faculty, I was one of two women. The other woman was the costume designer and for the productions, and maybe taught a class in costumes, but I think the main job was designing and sewing costumes. And I was working in a field, although my master's degree focused on George Bernard Shaw, I was working for and with four children. So it was a challenge, because one of my faculty members, colleagues, used to refer to me as the play lady. And, you know, you just, at that time, all you could do was smile, because nothing would be done about that kind of attitude. Many times I felt like I was a woman invading a man's world, and I certainly felt that way years later when I took a show to New York. So I think that it's an evolving situation for women in the theater. I remember years ago hearing a female lighting designer talk about how she was grateful that she had an opportunity to prove herself in a field, because lighting designers had been pretty much relegated to men, even directors at one time. our great friend Pat Birch talks of how difficult it was for her. She was a choreographer. She was a dancer with Martha Graham. And then, you know, it requires a lot of grit. It requires a lot of discipline.
Yes, yes. Tell me about it. Yes.
You have to let it roll off your back. Sometimes you can't, but sometimes you have to just scream.
Yes. I mean, you talked, and we will talk about the shows that you brought to Broadway, because you've got a couple of shows that you brought to Broadway, a number of shows that you brought to off-Broadway. One of them was a couple of them I was in. The challenges that brought also. But before we get that, I was very impressed with the company that by the time I had come along, the company that was formed and then I'd come in as a guest artist, I called them the teacher artists, because they were educated, but they were also people who could have made a career as actors who were chosen to be a part of this company. How did that whole process come? Did you decide that you wanted to have a company? And how long were they supposed to be in this company? Was it something that went that evolved as time went on? You know, did you have a formula for it, or did it just evolve as each play was created?
No, the idea was, my idea was to have a permanent company.
Move back again, Patricia. Move back. The angle of your phone, I think, because one time you're very clear, and then the angle of your phone changes. So move it back.
No.
Just move it back like that, because I want everyone to hear this. I want them to hear it clearly. Go. Mm-hmm.
The idea was to have a permanent company with a company that could live in the community and that have a full-time job. And we were very lucky at the time. The Comprehensive Training Act, our federal government, came through with grant monies for training people to do certain things, artists to teach, teachers to perform, and many different combinations like that. And those monies made it possible for us to bring together a company of 12. It was a diverse company, not as diverse as I wanted it to be. It was very difficult to find people in New York who wanted to relocate in Albany and live there full time and leave everything behind in the city, because they wanted that opportunity to have that New York gig.
Yes, of course.
And eventually, and what this made it possible for the actors to be teachers and some teachers to be retrained or trained, or their talent to be developed, because you have to have talent. You just can't train somebody to be an actor. They have to have some native talent to begin with. And maybe that's true of teachers, too, good teachers.
I think good teachers and native teachers, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Out of that, they were young and wonderful. And out of that, I saw that a young company can't realistically do every play that we would like to do for the young people. So at a particular time, I had a deputy producer working with me, Bill Franconis, And he said to me, you know, there are a lot of talented people out there who would be willing to come in to job in on a per-show basis. So we found the need to job in to the basic company for when the casting required it.
Yes.
But to live in the to be an actor and to live in the community brought another dimension, because it got people thinking about the arts. They weren't just guests or stars from New York. They were real people, and they were their neighbors. And this made people more willing to come out to the theater and to support the theater.
How did you get from that concept to going to New York with the plays that you took to Broadway? There are two plays, Raggedy Ann and His Honor. How did that evolve for you so that you had your company, but you had other artists? What motivation took you so that you wanted to go to the city?
It wasn't necessarily that I wanted to go to the city. One of the things that our board of directors was committed to, as were we, new works. So the new work brought authors that we had never worked with before, who were in New York, whose dreams were to go to New York. And we became familiar with the first instance, Joe Raposo, who wrote a lot of music for Sesame Street.
Yes, that's one of the names I was going to bring up. Joe is known for Being Green, the song Being
Green.
Yes.
Yes.
And I remember meeting him up there. He was very involved in a lot of the works that was going on there. Continue on. Yes.
Mm-hmm. So Joe, I met Joe. The first show we did together was the show that you and I did together, the All-Time Good Time Knickerbocker
Follies. Yes, that's when I met him. Mm-hmm. Yes, he was delightful. He was just lovely to be around. And knowing that he had such an integral part in the development of Sesame Street was really quite wonderful also.
Yes.
So bringing that
And
time,
Joe wanted to take a show to Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted four kids. And he said, how would you like to develop? And he proposed to me Raggedy Ann because he had composed the music for the animated version of Raggedy Ann and Andy.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And he said, my intention is to take this to New York. We need shows on Broadway. This was before Beauty and the Beast. We need shows on Broadway for the kids.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how that idea got started. We did one version, but he and the director, Pat Birch, didn't think the show was on the cutting edge enough to go to New York. And we had a second version with a book that was written by William Gibson, who wrote The Miracle Worker.
Another name that I was going to bring up. Yep, go ahead.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So anyway, we then got invited to Moscow with it, and we took it to Moscow. We were the first theater. Well, actually, the first arts event that took place in the Soviet Union after a six-year absence of a cultural exchange between the United States of America and the Soviet Union. And at that time, the show was not called Raggedy Ann. It was called Rag Dolly.
Mm-hmm.
And It was a great success in Moscow. There is a documentary, and someone has it. It's on YouTube. So if anyone's interested, they can go to YouTube and find. I think it's called Rag Dolly in the USSR.
Oh,
well. So, it was a success. We came back home. CBS became interested. Roger Stevens became interested. And it played at the Kennedy Center before it went into Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't do well on Broadway.
You had a short run on Broadway, but it was... I think eventful because there are a lot of things that learned about that production, about being on Broadway. Am I not right?
Oh, yes. I think, though, that one of the things I learned and stand by now, sometimes you learn from your mistakes. The production in Moscow was so honest, and the people who had created the roles should have been transitioned to the Broadway production. It was recast, and the show lost a lot, and then it got changed. And I learned that if an actor really works and invests himself or herself in a role, they should be given the right of first refusal. Actors work so hard. It's an intellectual, it's a mental, it's a physical commitment. And if they succeed, then they should be allowed to go further, even if they're from a place that no one's ever heard of.
Mm-hmm.
It's the talent, it's the honesty mm-hmm. that goes across the footlights. I don't think, you know. So anyway, I learned that I wasn't involved in the casting ultimately for the Broadway production because it was no longer my company. Only about 3 people from my company. The camel with the wrinkled knees and the little baby doll.
I think one of the things that we all learn, you know, in this business is that, and it's something that I think it still needs to be learned, is that the investment that actors put into something when they create something, when they initiate it, needs to be a little bit more appreciated, even if they are rewarded a percentage later on. Sometimes the replacement is just cosmetic. It's just because someone has a resume that seems a little bit more cosmetically pleasing to people. But a faith in the actor is a faith in the actor. And I think very much the people who had faith in me at the very beginning, because I didn't have the cosmetically pleasing credits, that people took a chance on me. And just taking a chance is a very important thing. But now I'm going to tell you this because I told you the time would go. We have less than half hour left. And I want to try to talk about His Honor, and I want to try to talk about some of the other productions. But before I do that, I want to throw out a couple of names to you, because I want people to understand that even this theater was the theater company that you created, the theater atmosphere you created, really went beyond the job description. It went beyond the job description and into making a footprint. And for me, the footprint that it made was it connected me with people that I think absolutely are icons in this business. So you've said two of the names that I was going to ask you about. I was going to ask you about Joe Raposo, and I was going to ask you about William Gibson. But what about, and I was going to ask you about Patricia Burt, so you've talked about them. What about Larry Kurt? What brings to mind about Larry Kurt? Because he was
Larry was wonderful.
Yeah.
Larry was, I think you know, the original Tony in West Side Story on Broadway.
Yes.
And he was a wonderful human being as well as a powerhouse of a performer. He was giving. He worked hard. And after Knickerbocker Follies, we remained friends. As a matter of fact, when Governor Mario Cuomo was inaugurated, he wanted the song, The Coming to America, sung on the stage with him.
You still have to move back a little bit, Patricia. You have to still move back a little bit more.
And Larry agreed to come and do the honor.
Mm-hmm.
So, and he worked well with the company. The company worked well with him. Well, you know, there are too many stories out there about people who are unfriendly or stuck on themselves. I don't think that's true. I think artists generally, they're good people. And caring people. They have to because their life is based on giving.
Larry was a sweetheart. So was Jack Gilford.
Oh. Jack Gilford.
These are men I got a chance to work with. They were absolutely fabulous. Go ahead. What does Jack Gilford bring to mind?
Well, you know, Jack Gilford made me laugh, made me smile. He was a funny man. But deep down, I was touched by his soul. We were going through that period of transition at the Theater Institute where celebrities were coming from New York and working with the company. And the company was a little skittish, but willing to make that adjustment. And I always credit the company because without the wonderful company that I had, even if there were disagreements here and there, they always brought it in. They never disappointed. Well, Jack Gilford, like you, sensed their discomfort. And he talked to the company about what it was like for him when he was blacklisted during the McCarthy era, which, of course, we have some of that going on now today.
Yes.
And he talked about how much he wanted to perform, how he hungered to perform, how much it hurt, and he was denied performing. And some of those soulful stories about what it was like to be accused of something that you were not guilty of really resonated and I think made us all richer and understanding that we don't ever want to put anyone through that again. He was a funny man on the stage, but, you know, it was kind of like laughing on the outside and crying on the inside.
How was Orson Bean? How was Orson Bean?
Orson Bean was a fun guy. You know, you worked with him.
Mm-hmm.
And he liked cats. He brought his cats to work with him. He favored the hotel. He would have to run to the hotel to feed those cats and to take care of those cats. He was a charmer, and he just fit right in. He seemed like just an all-around regular person.
George David White.
Oh, gosh.
And now tell people why they may not know his name, but why they should know who we're talking about. The song that he wrote. Because
what
he wrote
a wonderful
one
world.
For me, It's a Wonderful World. Now, that's what I'm talking about. But I was fortunate enough also for him to write the opening song to Ladies of Song for me. So, you know.
Yes, he did.
Yes,
he did.
Yeah.
And I have a picture of the two of you.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping that I can get it photoshopped so that I can put it in my book that I'm working on.
And that's another thing, your book. See, I'm telling you, we have less than 20 minutes. All right, I want to talk about the book.
George David Weiss, I want to talk about him a little bit.
All right.
He gave up so much time to the Theater Institute, and he collaborated with a variety of people. He collaborated with my son, Will. He collaborated with Ed Lang. He collaborated with Byron Janis, the concert pianist. He collaborated with Bill Franconis. And he worked very hard for very little and took great pride in the product. As a matter of fact, you were in his A Tale of Cinderella that Bill wrote the book for. George
yes.
did lyrics and music, and Will
yes.
did music and few lyrics. And that production had a very large exposure on Warner Home Video, A Tale of Cinderella. CD is on Atlantic Records. And we toured. You toured to K Playhouse.
Yes. Talking about K Playhouse, do you remember who came backstage? And I thought you invited her. I'll say the name. Patricia O'Neill. Did you invite her?
Oh, yes. Patricia O'Neill made a movie in our home. John Houseman brought her to our home. And they were in a movie. She played the wife of Fred Astaire. And our home that we lived in became their home in the movie. And she was also a friend of Dennis Buck, who was one of our music directors
yes,
and a composer.
Dennis. Yes.
And Dennis used to play for her on the cruises. She used to do entertain on cruises, and Dennis would accompany her. So, yes, she came to see. You know, it's interesting.
She came backstage
people like
to
Patricia
see Cinderella.
Neal. Yes, she did. She came to see Cinderella.
Yeah, I remember.
I'll tell
yeah.
you who else came to see Cinderella. But he was a very different person then than he has been in the last 4 years, the mayor of New York City, Rudy Giuliani. He came to see it.
Oh, okay. Well, I remember Ms. Neal. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I remember Ms. Neal because she came backstage and called certain performers downstairs. I was one of the ones that she called that she wanted to meet the stepmother. So I remember that moment and thinking, yes, and thinking Patricia Snyder must have invited her. But she was very insistent. She said, where's the stepmother? Where's the stepmother? And I went, oh, my gosh. You know, she was fabulous. It was, you know, again, the ability for those productions to communicate to a full audience of adults and children through the arts and education. So many productions that you did that were productions that educated people about things. And we're not going to be able to get to all of them now. I can see because we only have 15 minutes left. But, you know, I mean, you all did wonderful productions like Miracle on 34th Street. You did Magna Carta. You did Snow Queen. You know, these were all productions that had a history And through the arts, they were retold again so that adults could relive them as well as children. I remember when we went on tour with Snow Queen and adults coming up to me saying, oh, I've loved you all my life. And these are people who are older than I was.
Well, Lenny, I want you to know that I've been reading some of the reviews that you got with the Snow Queen, and one of them says, Lenny Godfrey exudes a fitting, majestic presence. And that was exactly why you were cast in the role. Another one on Ladies of Song, they called that you created a sensuous portrait of three divas, Ethel Waters, my favorite, Ella Fitzgerald, and Sarah Vaughan. And then there's another one that said, Lenny Godfrey is a divine diva.
Well, I must have sent him some good sex. That's what it was.
We had a good time, Lenny.
We did. It was fabulous. And at the same time, you know, the arts were educating people about the fact that characters didn't have to look exactly the same all the time. This colorblindness or non-traditional casting that you created an atmosphere for, where we just never got, there was never ever a mention that the characters were created by someone that didn't look like me, but everybody immediately accepted that convention, and it was a source of education for the adults as well as the children, you know. And I think that's an extraordinary accomplishment. Most people don't realize that was done over, you know, 30 years ago, and it wasn't easy. We weren't this aware of everything as we are now, even though it's a little difficult now. But people were accepting of it, you know, and that was an important thing. Now we're getting down to 10 minutes, and the amount of shows that I wanted to talk about that you brought to New York and everything else did not get into our conversation yet. And I'm going to, what I have to do is I'm going to read a list of a lot of shows that you brought to New York. And on Broadway, there was Raggedy Ann in his honor. Off Broadway, there was Counselor. There was Sleeping Beauty. The Slow Dance on the Killing Ground. The Tale of Cinderella. There was a tour of Handy Dandy. And then there was Snow Queen, not only in New York, but in London. And in Philadelphia. And then there were tours of the USSR, England, Sweden, Israel, Italy, Canada, France, Hungary, Jordan, all of those places that you really had an effect on the audience and brought so many different images in front of them so that it would educate them and let them see images that were very different. And now I want to open it up to anyone who question in these last 10 minutes before we end this, I told you it would go fast. I told you in this last 10 minutes, I think we're going to have a couple of questions. People who might want to ask you questions, Patricia, I want them to get an opportunity. So we do have a question now, and I'm going to go to it. Please say your name and where you're from. Thank you very much. And welcome to Lenny Godfrey, Straight No Chaser. Hello.
Hi. Hello. My name is Deborah, a former teacher from New York City, and I'm calling because these wonderful stories that I'm hearing are so rich in history, and I just feel that today we live in such a disposable world of young people who really don't go deep in the study of theater and drama. So do you feel that that is one of the things that is lacking today in some of the classes that are being taught to young people on theater and on having a career in the business?
Yes, I do. I feel that textbook and lecture learning is only part of an education. I've always believed that education also includes experiential leading, experiential learning. Unfortunately, the schools, and it's not the school's fault, it has to do with the Board of Regents, they keep cutting the arts. The government doesn't fund the arts, and that's unfortunate because through the arts, our young people can walk in another person's shoes and develop empathy that's sorely needed in our world.
Thank you. I certainly agree with you.
Thank you, Deborah.
Thank you for the question.
And before we go on, we have a few more minutes. I want to ask you, at one point, you say there's two things. I want to see if I can, I can't because there's another question. So hold on, Patricia, there's another question. I have to go to the question. Yes, please tell your name and where you're from. Hello.
Hello. My name is John. Is it all right to be a groupie of you, Lenny, and Patricia? Because I'm a groupie from way back. And I want to say my experience with both of you has been fabulous over the years. And I've been enjoying listening to you for the last many minutes and going back over memory lane with all of this. And really it is. I want to emphasize for anybody who isn't believing in any of this, this is all true experiences. And even to this day when I was at the post office and two strangers came up to me and said, I know you. We saw you at the theater and you were the scarecrow and it was wonderful and I hadn't seen them for 20 years. So, yes, the people we touched still believe in us now as I believe in both of you. So I just wanted to say hello, love you both, and I'm enjoying this with all my heart. Thank you. Love you too,
John McGuire.
Thank you, John McGuire. Love you. Thank you. Well,
yes,
he was
the scarecrow for, I think it was 9 productions.
Really? Really?
9 different productions.
He was just, he's just my heart, my John McGuire. He's just wonderful. But
yes.
you see, it's just one of those things where I think that people are still really needing what we were doing a long time ago. And it's good that we haven't stopped doing it, Patricia. One of the things that I do want to say is you talk to me, and I'm going to talk to Melba Tolliver about it, about Evelyn Cunningham being a mentor of yours. Just quickly tell people who Evelyn Cunningham is, because it's an important thing, I think, before we get off the air. Go on.
Well, Evelyn Cunningham was a reporter. And she wrote stories about the early civil rights unrest. And she came to Governor Rockefeller's attention. And Governor Rockefeller hired her to become head of the women's, he created a women's unit in New York State. And she became head of the women's unit. I think it preceded anything in the federal government or any other state in the country. But Evelyn loved the arts. She was a wonderful writer. And she would be featured many times in the New York Times because she had such a wonderful, slender body that she was also a model. And I would love to talk to Melba Tolliver about her to see what she knows to share stories. But I believe that Evelyn eventually married the gentleman who was head of the Newport Jazz Festival.
I see.
And she took me by the hand and introduced me to a lot of black artists in New York, designers, actors. I met Billy through
Billy
her.
Allen? Yes.
Yes.
Move back, Patricia.
Okay.
Yes, good. There you go.
I'm sorry, my phone is like tinny. It's terrible.
Well, that's all right. We're getting through it. We just want to hear the stories. I mean, it's so important. Go ahead.
So anyway, Evelyn took me by the hand. It came after we had done a play that raised a few questions, and she took me by the hand and educated me and took me to New York. Well, I don't know if she was originally from New York. That's what I don't know. Ultimately, she went to serve President Ford, but I'm thinking I realize why, because Governor Rockefeller went to New York to become President Ford's vice president, so he talked her in. She became a special assistant to President Ford. She's a fantastic, educated, caring, compassionate woman, and I owe a lot to her. She taught me a lot.
I remember you mentioning to her to me a long time ago, and I found an interview where she went down to, I guess it was Mississippi, and tried to interview Bull Connors, because this is a woman of color. And the reporters said, well, you know, good luck with that, because he's not entertaining anybody for interview. But she went up to him. She didn't get the interview, but she actually went up to him and said, though, that she was afraid for her own life, that when she confronted Bull Connors. So we're talking about a lot of people who, like I said, go beyond their footprint, their job descriptions, and do their footprint. One of the things that, and we're going to do an after show afterthought, and I invite everyone to, once we videotape it, is to look at it on YouTube and Godly Entertainment, because one of the questions that I did not get a chance to ask Patricia, and I will on the after show, is for her to think about the good moments, her best moment, and one moment that wasn't her best moment. But I'm going to have to take a hold of this and say it's going to be good evening for us and good night for this show, Patricia, because we have almost less than a minute left. I want people to know that next week the activists, the Dynamo corporate executive consultant, will be my conversationalist next week, and I hope you all tune in. But I want you to also look at the after show afterthoughts, because we're going to continue this in a little bit. I thank you all so much for joining us. Patricia,
thank you, Lenny.
Thank you for coming in. And, you know, I mean, it's a lifetime for us to try to do in an hour. It's just really hard, you know, but we'll do some more. And I thank you all for tuning in, and we'll see you next time on Lenny Godfrey Straight, No Chaser.
This is something we all know. Fever isn't such a new thing. Fever started long ago. Never know how much I love you. You never know how much I care. When you put your arms around me, I get a feeling that's too hard to bear. You give me fever. When you kiss me,